My husband expected me to have a hot meal for him every day when he got home from work and wanted to return to an immaculate house. The provider deserves to eat, he would always tell me. What this worthless sack of flesh never considered is that I too was the provider because I too had a good job. Then we had kids and he wanted me to be a stay-at-home mother. Sir, you cannot afford that. So I asked him if he'd be funding my retirement, splitting his earnings with me, and ensuring I had access to independent resources. I did the math, and the money I was asking for was about 2% of the actual market value of the labor he'd be getting in return. This man called me a gold digger. So I'm still working, and he's still thumping his chest about being a provider, all while doing fuck all at home and generally making life more miserable for all of us. Sometimes I channel the uppity negress when he starts talking about being a traditional man, because that's when I tell him, fine, be a traditional man and go die in a war already. He has been a labor digger since day one, and I am so glad I now have the language to name it. Hi, I'm Zonva Lines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood podcast, and that was an amazing story. Before we get started, just a reminder that you can support this podcast by heart reacting on Substack or leaving a positive review. And social media, sharing and commenting make a huge difference, huger than you would realize because social media is trying to suppress leftist creators. So if you want this podcast to grow and continue, please continue engaging. If you really like the podcast, you can also become a paid subscriber. Paid subscribers get bonus podcast episodes as well as at least 8 extra articles a month. Sign up at zon.substack.com. Today, we are talking about labor diggers, and that wonderful voice you heard laughing is the legendary Kiki Bryant, known on social media as the Uppity Negress. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Son. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here, but I'm going to read your very brief bio and then we'll get started.
Okay.
Kiki Bryant, known online as the Uppity Negress, is a mother, writer, and sociopolitical critic located in Chicago, Illinois. And I just do have to add this. It's not always true, but it often is that the most impressive people often have the shortest bios because they see the work as much bigger than themselves and their own work speaks for itself. That's definitely the case with Kiki. It's such an incredible and astute writer and critic and thinker and just brain on stilts. And she's just amazing. And she's published books on decentering whiteness, decentering men, and setting boundaries, all of which I will link to in the show notes. She also has a Substack. She's all over social media. And her social media page is just this great combination of like dopamine bursts and education and meaningful activism. So if you're not already following her, you are definitely missing out. So we'll get
Oh.
started. Kiki, I just love you and your work so much. The way I found you was that a few years ago, I made a post about kind of the topic we're talking about, the irony of men calling women gold diggers when they were the ones treating their partners as like appliances. And immediately, I had like five people who told me about you and your concept of labor diggers and tagged you. So I'm like, oh, who is this person? I have to go stalk her. And then I was just immediately sold. You were in the middle of some social media argument with somebody or other, and I had no idea what was going on, but I was immediately invested. And I was just like, this woman is hilarious and just like so brilliant. So tell me how you got started. Like, who are you? How did you get to be this way?
The short answer to that question is complex childhood trauma. The long answer to that question is just, a lot of life experience. Growing up in Chicago, my mother, she was an addict, and so I've kind of been hyper independent my whole life. I married early, and just kind of I won the lottery in a lot of ways, in that I was given a jack of all trades kind of litany of talents, and just autistic pattern recognition, and the combination of all of those things is why I am the way that I am. What was the question again? Can you repeat that?
Well, like, I guess, I guess my question is how this like all started for you with
Got you.
being this like astute critic of all of the things that so many of us see. But the thing that I see when I read your work, and I think the thing that makes a lot of us feel so connected to you, is that it feels like you look at things and you just kind of immediately know what they actually are. And that's really a rare talent.
So I would say that my social presence grew from my actual personal page. And so on my personal page, as you know, current events were happening, I would just kind of give my take on things. And then back in the olden days, you know, your Facebook profile wasn't always kind of public. And so when they made the ability to have your profile be public or your post be public, more people are like, hey, can you make this public? I want to share it. Like, I think it's incredibly, you know, valuable or interesting or profound or whatever. And over time, you know, me just being a mother first and foremost, it felt kind of weird to have posts with my children alongside, you know, all of the very kind of controversial, sometimes sociopolitical commentary and the types of traffic it would bring to my page. And so someone told me in 2017, so almost a decade ago, which is forever in internet years, someone's like, you need to make your own page, like a separate page, like a business page, and put all of these ideas there. And they also told me to start a podcast. So I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'll try that. And so my partner at the time and I started a podcast, and my page is still the page from that podcast. And so over time, we stopped doing the podcast just because editing audio makes me want to shoot myself in the head. But just the main thing is that community was being built around my post, my ideas, my engagement. And I've just kind of kept that going. And you know, ironically, when I first started per kind of posting on my personal page, my ex-husband was very, very, very unsupportive of that. He was very unsupportive. And there's a direct quote of him. He told me that I post too much black stuff. Too much black stuff, and that I needed to just focus on being a wife and a mom because at the time I was a stay-at-home mom. And so it's just kind of my outlet for all the things going on in my inner world while I stayed home with my baby. And immediately I was like, no, like this makes me happy for whatever reason, you know, and it makes other people happy. So why would I stop it? And you know, 10 years later ish, here we are.
I really felt like that might end with, and 10 years later, he's dead because I murdered him.
He is not dead, but is he doing as well as I am? No.
That's fair. Okay, so I want to, before we get into labor diggers, I have a question because I know that you lost your Facebook page, and I
I
actually
did.
think that's an important thing to talk about because I think that's something that everybody who is like a writer or a creator on Facebook knows about as a phenomenon. But I think people kind of like in the general public who are perhaps less invested in these things don't know about this. And it's a really important speech and justice issue. So can you talk about what
Oh,
happened?
I can talk about this for days on. Lesser known fact about me, is that I actually used to have my own social media platform, and my platform was called The Cookout. And the reason that I started The Cookout is because just by nature of me being black and woman and queer and all of the other progressive things, and having progressive ideas rather, Facebook would shadow ban me. Like crazy. Like there are times where my reach on a post would be one. And I, you know, pattern recognition just kind of put out a survey at one point, and I was just like, hey, who is Facebook banning? Why? What types of things are they banning for? Because I do have training as a user experience designer. And it turns out if you are black and woman and queer, you will get banned almost twice as much as somebody who is a white man. And it goes up the more intersections you have, the more likely you are to be banned. That was kind of what the takeaway was from that survey. And Right before the election in 2024, Facebook completely deleted my old page. And it broke my heart because, I'm a writer. And so that was near 8 years of just writing that I had put out into the world and that people had loved and connected with. And I'm not the only one. They did it to a bunch of us. And so I had to restart my page from scratch. Now, in retrospect, I will say that them doing that was good for, kind of the business of my writing because it made me hyper aware of the fact that if I'm too reliant on a singular platform and that platform takes away for me, then that loss is there. And so that's what kind of pushed me to go on to Substack to get my writing on my website to make sure that I have a presence on more than one main platform. And so, in between Threads and Facebook and Substack and my own website, it just taught me to diversify myself and to just not be so reliant on a singular platform. But it is sucky because all things considered, the only people keeping Facebook alive, I feel, are creators like you and I. And then, the other side of that is like your 68-year-old grandma who's sharing AI conservative memes, which nobody likes those anyway. And then, content creators who are completely apolitical. And it's interesting to me that out of all of those, creators like us are the ones that are the most silenced because AI slop, nonsense, conservative bullshit gets to go as far as it wants to with no consequence. But there is a point in time on Facebook where you could not type the word men without getting a ban.
Yeah, it's just so wild. So there's this concept. So my husband is a civil rights lawyer, and so he does well now he does police shootings, but he used to do a lot of speech cases. And there's this concept of like the traditional public square, and that there are certain locations that have always been sites for speech, and that like the standard for limiting speech in those places it should be higher. Because those are sites of important speech. And, obviously that should exist, but the world is evolving and it's now become that social media is a site for important speech. And there are no protections. They can literally silence you, and not just silence you, but take away everything you have previously said. It's so
Absolutely.
scary.
It's incredibly scary. And that's the thing that makes me the saddest. So I'm just coming up on a year of having to have like restarted my page from Facebook deleting it. And so I'm getting memories again. And I kind of had some awareness of like how important it is to be able to kind of call back to things you've written before or observed before. And so much of my writing now is literally me just looking at old ideas of mine and saying, like, with new eyes, with new experience, with new connections that I've made in my brain, what does that look like now? And the ability to do that is so powerful. And I would say like that is the number one thing that has contributed to my personal growth and, my growth as a writer is that I'm always willing to look back on something that I used to think or whatever and consider that I might have been wrong or that I might have been young and dumb and that what does it look like now?
Yeah.
And it's great to be able to do that. And that's the main thing that I feel like I lost when they took away all of those years of my writings. And that's the thing that makes me really sad because I think there's also something really valuable in the authenticity or in transparency to say, like, hey, you see me now and you think that I'm this just like morally superior person, but no, it was a journey to get here too. And taking away kind of the evidence of that journey is kind of messed up, but Zuckerberg and his reptilian leadership do what they do, and we are all just beholden to the whims of the Facebook gods.
Yeah, while you're saying this, I'm thinking about we have this idea that like social media has created this renaissance of speech. And in a lot of ways it has, but I don't think that there's ever been a time, certainly not in recent history, when you could not just silence a person, but eliminate all of the things they have previously said. And that's
Yeah.
just like,
It's a digital equivalent of book burning.
yeah, it really is. It's so sad and so upsetting. But let's talk about labor diggers on a happier note. I hear so often from these shit ass, literally, men that they're providers and protectors. All of this mythologization of just having a job, as if that's not something people have to have and that women generally do too. So, what is a labor digger? Talk to me. Explain this to people who have not heard this term.
Yeah, so labor digger is a term that I coined, and not only coined, but operationalized, where it describes a certain kind of dynamic that is primarily within the context of heterosexual relationships, where the man has the job that he has, and the woman most likely also has a job, but she is carrying 100% of all of the other associated labor with maintaining their lives. And I think that it has a lot to do with the fact that the role of women, especially in the last, 60, 70 years, has evolved so much, but the role of men has remained largely the same. And so the man is still going to work and then coming home and expecting dinner and, whiskey by the fireplace. But the woman is no longer just staying home, taking care of the kids and everything, and waiting for him to get home to do that. She has her own job, her own friends, her own life. And so essentially the woman ends up doing a bunch of jobs, whereas the man only has one. And the economic impact of that on married working mothers is incredible. Like, that's why, in my opinion, I can't say for certain, but in my opinion, that is exactly why married women over the course of their lifetime make less than single women, because they, being the default parent, is a big drain on like women's ability to be present in the workplace. And I think that the pandemic did a great job of exposing that, where you are both working from home, but every time that the child needs something, it's the woman who has to stop her work to go tend to them. And there was a big rush over the pandemic of women who actually lost their jobs or had to quit their jobs as a result of the dynamic. And it's messed up. And so, me myself having experienced that, I was a stay-at-home mom with my first child for the majority of her early childhood. But when I did start working, I thought that it made sense that then my husband would be kicking in more around the house. And that just didn't happen the way that I thought it would. And it created a bunch of resentment in our relationship. And probably was a big factor in our divorce. And I also noticed that me working outside the home did not automatically, for example, change the level of like who he felt should be making financial decisions, and so it's a big divide, I think, that a lot of women are dealing with and kind of trying to figure out. Because again, the role of women has changed so much in recent history, but the role of man hasn't. And a lot of men don't want to evolve. And so, where does that leave the state of cis heterosexual marriage?
It doesn't leave it in a very good place, but
It doesn't. That's
I
why marriage rates are so low and divorce rates are so high, because there's a period of time where like maybe we were evolving more to like have more of our own money, but like maybe divorce was more frowned upon, or maybe women couldn't have their own bank account, and so they kind of had to stick around a little bit longer. But now that we can have our own money, our own assets, our own whatever, it's like, really, what am I here for? And the studies also show that single mothers do less work around the house. They make more money than married mothers. And so, it seems like the married singled mothers are worse off overall in terms of lifetime happiness, earning potential than the married single mothers. I'm sorry, than the regular single mothers.
Yeah, I mean you're absolutely right. I certainly see this in the women that I work with where they get divorced and suddenly they have less work and they just can't believe it. And it really
Absolutely.
it makes clear that this is not the small trivial issue that folks want to make it out to be. And I mean you've seen them and you've written about them, all these think pieces that talk about this as if it's funny, as if it's a small thing, as if it's not
No, it's huge. And
critical.
I've experienced that as well, where after divorcing, like just being amazed at how much less I had to do because I had removed my biggest responsibility from the household. And taking care of babies, kids is simple. And the struggles with single motherhood aren't necessarily because of a lack of a man in the home. It's really mostly economic, but if you're a single mother and you make enough to support your lifestyle and your children, of course a second income would be great, but it's like, what is the trade-off? What is your personal breaking point that makes it worthwhile? For me, it's not really worthwhile at all. I'm gonna just be honest with you. I've chosen at this point to live my life kind of intentionally solo polyamorous. I don't really desire to ever get married again or to cohabitate with a romantic partner, if the romantic partner is a cis man. And that is an intentional decision that I've made for my life. And I'm happy. I'm very happy. I have my own house. I never have to feel like I'm cleaning up after an adult. I only date other adults with their own homes who, take care of it. And that's what works for me. And it's just good to be at a point in history where I could do that and I can make those decisions and not really have to worry about, what anybody has to say or not being really financially dependent on a man in a way that like our foremothers had to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you say I'm happy, almost like I can hear the delight in your voice, but there's also like a little bit of surprise, and it's not surprising. And I think that it would be so good if we could shift our conversation toward, and I think you've helped with this with the concept of labor diggers, toward what is the cost of having a man in your home? Because it's kind of like the best case scenario is he's extracting a bunch of labor. And the worst case scenario is like almost unfathomable. It's like a limitless amount of abuse.
So I'll push back. I think that there are men who make, partnering with them worthwhile. I also think that those men are exceedingly rare.
Yeah, I mean that's true. I mean I'm in an equitable feminist marriage with like, my husband brings immense value to the home that is like not a paycheck. And I think in some ways that has made me more critical of heterosexual marriage because it's
Oh,
made clear to
absolutely.
me like, oh, like they can do this and they can also do this and like still be happy. And they're not doing it because they don't want to.
It's sucky.
So I think you hit the nail on the head a few comments ago when you talked about how men don't want to evolve. And like that's it. But what I see is this kind of like mass gaslighting of like, well, you need to communicate better and you need to present things to him in the
And
right
make a
way.
list.
Make a list. Have you tried trying?
I think that that is such bullshit. And of course, we all know that it's bullshit because you know that the dishes need to be washed. If you don't know how to wash dishes by now, it's not hard to figure out. There are so many things that your father did not teach you to do or your mother didn't teach you to do, but you figure it out anyway because you want to. They don't want to. No little girl grows up like, oh my God, I cannot wait to wash 4 people's worth of dishes every day until I die. But girls are kind of conditioned to do that. We don't condition boys to do that. And even though I raise my children with, genderless expectations, a lot of people do. And I think that that's also part of the problem, is that a lot of people, unfortunately, are raising their sons to believe that this is normal, okay behavior, and that certain domestic labor is for girls. I was certainly raised that way. In my house, the girls were expected to do certain kinds of labor, and the boys were expected to do other kinds of labor, and that was just the expectation. And, going back to something you said earlier about kind of the cost of having a man in home. I kind of come at that from a different perspective, being a Black woman and being a Black woman who was born kind of in the age of the crack epidemic, where a lot of men specifically were removed from the home for, selling drugs and, mass incarceration. So I grew up feeling like, a husband was going to be the answer to all of life's problems, and that we were going to walk off into the sunset with our happy family and everything was going to be great. And I actually struggled for a long time with the concept of divorcing, just because that is not an uncommon thing to think in the Black community. And sometimes if you look at Black social commentary now, there's this big focus on you need to be married, you need to be married, you need to be married, because of that trauma that happened to our entire community. And there's a direct kind of, I don't know if it's a correlation or a causation, but if you look at mass incarceration goes up, there's a direct connection with that and Black marriage rates going down, because a man who is not physically out cannot be really family focused, and that's part of the problem. But as with a lot of traumas that have been inflicted on kind of the Black community at large, if you're able to kind of look outside of the machinations of just race, and look at kind of the larger picture, the unique way that Black manhood interacts with patriarchy is definitely distinct from obviously white manhood, but there are a lot of commonalities, unfortunately. And honestly, I think that there's a lot of commonalities with Black manhood and white womanhood. And I've written about that before, and I might need to port that over to my Substack. But in all of these things, women are usually below men, and that is not untrue for the Black community. There's a writer that I enjoy on Facebook. Her name is Kathy Henry. She has a quote that she posts every now and again. She goes, "In the Black community, dick is God." And she's not wrong about that. And I often say that I feel like Black men have been held accountable for things that they didn't do so long that we have forgotten how to hold them accountable for things that they have done. And that's part of the problem, too. And so with Black gender relations, it is a very fine line between figuring out what is trauma, and how you navigate that, and then figuring out what is actually just plain patriarchal bullshit. And a lot of people in the Black community struggle with that. And even sometimes, if you're looking at my comments and you see me talking about, a women's right issue, sometimes people will come up and kind of parrot something that spawns from that ideology of like, well, Black men don't really get to be men in the same way white men do, but like, why are we fighting for that to be the standard? And you see that a lot with especially conversations on rape culture, where it's like, well, Epstein gets to da 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 da, so why can't Diddy? Why do we want Diddy to do that? And I feel like I just went on a very long tangent of connecting a lot of ideas that seem separate.
You did, but I appreciate you doing this. So like, while you're talking, I'm always thinking about like, okay, what can I follow up on? But there's like so many threads in that to pull on. I feel like Each of them is a podcast. So I'm just going to follow up on a few things and you can go in whatever direction you want because, like,
Yeah,
you're
for
the
sure.
expert
And if
on
we need a
this.
part two, that's fine too.
Oh, I think, I mean, if you're committing to a part two right now, like, I'm going to put you on my calendar. So, yeah, the bit about Black men being taken from their families, I want to focus on that a little bit because something that I see so much, particularly in white feminism, which has, become kind of the dominant feminist narrative, is this emphasis on carceral solutions to acts of violence against women. And, most people are never prosecuted, but those who are eventually get out. And I think most people do not understand how profoundly abusive our prison system is in the United States. The amount of abuse people sustain in this system is abuse no one should ever experience, like ever, no matter what they have done. My biggest fear, having familiarity with the prison system, is going to prison because it's horrific. And we send people in and we just break them and then expect them to come out okay. And it's not a coincidence that we've been taking Black men from their families and then saying, well, look at how absent Black men are when we've literally locked them in cages. And then when we release them, they're just completely traumatized. So, of course, they can't do it.
Absolutely. That's, something that I feel like Black women think about a lot. Because unfortunately, the stats show Black women are the most likely to be victimized by a partner or, a close acquaintance. Most of the world is very segregated. The people in your community most likely look like you. And I personally have known maybe one person that has ever gone all the way with seeking kind of carceral justice against an abuser. But almost every Black woman that I know has been abused in some way by a romantic partner. And of course, Black women date out the least. And so you can draw your own inferences from there. And there is this sort of prevailing narrative of, you don't go to the police because then you're putting this person's life in danger. But then what do? I will say that I feel like options to leave, and have our own kind of jobs and stuff definitely helps with just the process of getting away. But we also know that the time that an abuser is most dangerous to your life is right after you leave. And so it is a very delicate balance that Black women in particular have to walk. And I do, on some levels, understand the concept of just fuck it and let the police handle it. But then, there have been Black women that have been murdered for going that route. And so it's kind of a lose-lose situation for Black women, unfortunately. I personally am willing to shoot anybody who puts their hands on me in that way. And because unfortunately, when it comes down to it, realistically, the only people that it seems really protect Black women are other Black women, and that's a harrowing reality. And yeah, I don't have a pretty bow to end that one with.
Oh, well, you don't need to have a pretty bow. But even with the shooting part, I have a friend right now, a Black woman who was in an abusive relationship, going through the exact same things that you're identifying. Had just left, he was escalating, threatening to harm the family, and then tried to harm the family, and she shot and killed him in self-defense. And now she's on trial for murder. And I do not believe that, a blonde white lady like me would be less likely to be tried for murder. But I mean, everyone knows we prosecute women more harshly than men, but we
Oh,
prosecute
absolutely.
Black
I
women most harshly of all.
most women in jail are there because of an abuser in some way,
Yes.
in my opinion.
Oh,
Now,
yeah.
I'm not sure what the exact stats are, and so I can't say, this percent or whatever, but that it's my understanding that that's an objective fact that like most women who are have like credible evidence of being abused by the person that they shot or were being coerced into committing a crime by someone who was abusing them, and that's a sucky reality as well. And so it's really a lose-lose situation. And
You're absolutely right. I had our last podcast episode was Sabia Wade, who worked with the Prison Birth Project, or the Prison Doula Project, I think is what it's called. And she talked about how even the women who had been prosecuted and convicted of seemingly terrible crimes, they were really just their abusers' accomplices. They weren't the actual perpetrators. And so many are there for survival crimes. It's just awful. And we now have research showing that in states that mandate an abuse or an abuse, an arrest, which is often an abuse in a domestic violence situation, the woman who is the victim is more likely to be arrested than the man. Right?
That's really the only response I have to that. It's just deep sigh.
It's so awful. All right, so I want to talk about your books that you've written because you've just been so prolific this last year. So one of the dynamics that I often see with women in my work, and that I know that you're seeing because you've written about it, is that a man will hurt them and then they will seek validation from their abuser. They're constantly trying to convince these men to see their labor, to love them, to acknowledge that they have been harmed. And they've It's like they can't exit the situation until they get that validation that never comes. And it never comes because your abuser and exploiter is never going to be the person to heal you. So,
Absolutely.
this to me illustrates why it's so critical for women to decenter men, whether or not they choose to have romantic relationships with them. So, can you talk to me about this concept and talk to me about your book on decentering men?
So literally all of my journals came about because of me just looking at discourse in my comments and a lot of people trauma dump in my comments because it feels like a safe space. And that's a double-edged sword too. And I've read so many comments where I'm like, this is a journal thought. Bring back journals. And so I was like, okay, people think that I'm a safe space. They like the way that I phrase things, makes them think about stuff or feel safe to express things that they don't feel safe to do anywhere else. What can I do with that? And so that's where kind of my series of books came from. And they are all reflection journals, although I am working on, some novels. The first one that I came out with was Boundaries, because every time I'm talking about, how I date or how I approach relationships, even, whether familial, platonic, whatever, people are like, you have such great boundaries. I wish I could do that. And I'm like, but you can. And so, this is the uppity negus brand of boundaries, and this is how you apply them. And the response to that was just amazing. Everybody's like, wow, like I wish I read this years ago. And anybody who's ever been a part of my online community knows that I'm a big believer in people doing their own work and doing their own research. And so instead of me just kind of publishing a book where I'm just kind of talking at a person is what it feels like. I was like, no, a journal feels more right for this because I want you to figure out how to do your work in your own way. And so after the first Boundaries journal was a big hit and people were like, I love it. The next was that was a stretching baby. The next was Decentering Men. And that I feel of all of the titles on my site, that's the one that I feel is the most important one to women for reasons that you just named. Because so much of women's lives right now revolves around a man in some way. And obviously, I arrived at a place where I feel like men are almost entirely decentered in my life because, the work never stops. But so many women, like their whole life in some way revolves around men. You have the pick me girls, the not like other girls, and I know that back when I thought that way, it didn't make me happy, and it didn't lead me to the promise of the outcome that they say you're supposed to get when you're that woman. When you're the pick me girl, you're supposed to get the fairy tale wedding with the man who loves and is going to take care of you. But I also have the series, These Can't Be the Husbands You Swear I Want, because so many of these husbands are not that man. But those women are still with those husbands because they feel like they have to be. And that's sad too. And so decentering men to me is just about living your life for you. What do you actually want when you take away all of the outside noise of the patriarchy, right? I've always wanted more children, right? And the world that we operate in says you should only have children if you're married. Like I said, I don't have any desire to get married. I don't have any desire to cohabitate with a man. I have a newborn. And so I decided, kind of with open eyes, to have my baby anyway and not care about anything about that, because I know that having children has always made me happier than any man ever has, than any cohabitation situation ever has, than any, marriage ever has. And so one of the pages in my Decentering Men journal, it asks the user, what are you not allowing yourself to have that you want because you feel like you need a man to do it? That thing for me was having more children. And obviously you kind of need a cis man, or a person who produces sperm to physically have a baby. But I didn't feel like I needed to find the perfect man to have my baby. And so, my situation is non-traditional, and I'm not going to really go into details on, my relationship with my child's father, but it works for us. And I have what I wanted, which is my baby. And I, on social media, when I'm talking about my family, I refer to him as a jar opener, because he, in the grand scheme of this situation going on, he's kind of a non-player character. I'm the main character. I'm the protagonist. You play the video game as me, and he's just off over there somewhere. And that's, I mean, that if I don't really think it could get more decentered for men than that.
It's like funny that you say that because I think that's the reality of most women who are with cis men is that he's like a non-player character. He's just occasionally around, often making things worse. But like
Now, I
women
did
aren't,
choose one that makes it better, but
but like just not really there that much. And like, but women feel like they're not allowed to acknowledge that. And so they have to pretend that he's a lot more than he is. And I love it for you that you have found a positive situation where you are still allowed to acknowledge, like, it's really me doing all of this.
And as someone who has been a married single mother, it felt like it's just me anyway. And so if we live in a world where a woman is going to do the majority of the labor for the household, right? Is it really worthwhile? I always said I didn't want to have children past 35, and that's more of a financial decision, because I want to live on somebody's island with no children by a certain age. And so as I'm approaching 35, and I know I want another child, I know what I don't want also. How do I give myself kind of the life that I wanted, And I found a man who was worthwhile to procreate with. But even if I didn't find that man, I would have been a single mother by choice and gone to a sperm bank and would have told everybody to suck my dick if they had a problem with it, or had negative things to say about it, because fuck you. At the end of the day, the woman is going to do most of the child rearing work, especially in those first like 1 to 3, 1 to 3 years. And that's just kind of the nature of how those early years work, unfortunately, especially me as an exclusive breastfeeding mother. And so, my ex-husband would quote unquote help when he got home from work. And it was always nice when he helped. But now, like, I have my quote unquote help, and I just kind of feel like the trade-off for me of having a man around all the time is not worthwhile. 'Cause I like having my baby most of the time. I really love that. Like, I'm really cherishing these moments. And I've built a life where I can really just focus on being a mommy. I'm almost, entirely self-employed at this point. And when I think back on what I want my life to be, I want the story of my life to be that I poured everything that I had into my children, first and foremost, but then also all of these kooky ideas in my head out into the world. And none of those things for me center a man and what he can do. They're all about me and what I can do. And some people might think that that's self-centered. And I say thanks. Because when I look back at my life, I want it to have centered myself.
I think that's the least self-centered thing I could imagine is wanting to pour into your children. And I'm so happy for you that this is how it's happening. It's just great. It's like great to watch from a distance. I want to ask you about something I have been thinking about that I feel like you're the right person to help me kind of like untangle. So
Okay.
you mentioned Pick Me Girls, okay? And we all know about them. I'm noticing a different type lately.
Oh.
And this type is the I'm not like the other feminist girls. And here's what I mean by that. I mean women who read feminist or like leftist generally content. And they post something that's like, I'm the only woman I've ever known who's a real anti-racist, who doesn't center men. And who thinks for herself, and all the other women are just thoughtless and obsessed with men and obsessed with society. It's like the same thought process of separating yourself from other women, but with this like weird leftist bent that still
Oh.
has the same effect of denigrating women as like stupid and trivial.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I've also noticed that behavior, and I've also noticed a similar behavior in leftists with racism as well that I've been untangling, and I don't have the language for it just yet either, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And I've been trying to figure out how to describe those people as well. Like, and it is very annoying. And it kind of is similar to like competitive parenting. Like
Yeah.
this is competitive feministing. Like I am more feminist than you, and that means that I am better than you, and you need to feminist the way that I feminist. And it's silly. Especially when you recognize that like a lot of those women that I have interacted with, they're not very much feminist at all. You know what I think that they are? They're temporarily disenchanted pick-me's. And
Yeah.
the temporarily disenchanted pick-me is a woman who, at her core, she is a pick-me, but maybe she had a recently bad experience with a man that has made her go like to the far extreme. But the second that the right man is showing her the right amount of attention or the right kind of attention, she's gonna revert.
Yeah, I think we're witnessing in real time. You've come up with the term. Like, that's it. That's what they are. You did it, like right here.
So temporarily disenchanted pick me is something that I've noticed before where and I have a specific example of a person who I'm not gonna name, but after we go off live, I'm gonna ask you if you know the person because she is kind of popular in feminist thoughts and she
Oh, I'm
kind
excited. I'm really
of.
excited.
But yeah, temporarily disenchanted, blah, 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 blah. Temporarily disenchanted pygmies are very, very common where they think that their personal trauma or like personal grief is a substitute for praxis. But of course, it is not, which is why it's never lasting.
Yes. Oh, that's yeah. Okay. I'm eager to see you writing and talking more about this, so I hope that you will. So speaking of competitive parenting, you just published a piece on Substack on breastfeeding while Black. I urge everyone to go read it right now because it's really well written and entertaining, but it's also so dense with information. Like every sentence is so quotable. But in it you say, "What I resent is the way white women seem constitutionally incapable of engaging in a practice without turning it into a competition or locating their sense of purpose in feeling superior to someone else." I mean, that's like a whole sermon. Can you talk about that?
So I am very popular online, and most people in America are white, but the primary demographic of my page is it centers Black womanhood just because I feel like it's important to have a space that does. And sometimes it gets so frustrating where I'm talking about something that is like cultural or communal, and white women will pop up to correct me about it. And they get really defensive when I tell them, like, hey, you kind of don't know what you're talking about. It's like no one has ever told Susan that she was uninformed and that she needed to shut the fuck up, and you can tell. And I just posted a video about that, how some people just need to be told to shut the fuck up because it's clear nobody has ever told them to shut the fuck up and they really need to. And it is kind of competitive. And I, on a different Substack article, I wrote something along these lines of like, your interactions with Black women will improve if you accept these things. And one of those is that you're not always a fucking authority. Because a lot of white women seem to really struggle with that, and I call there's a certain kind of white woman that I call a member of the digital HOA, because it's they feel like it's their whole job to patrol the digital neighborhood and issue permits and citations for behaviors that they feel, aren't allowable or permissible. But I don't live in your neighborhoods, Karen. So you cannot give me a citation. You can't find me. And it all comes back to like control and competitiveness. And both of those things, white women are used to being controlling of Black women because in different times, and I said this in my article, in different times, you would be the expert on how to breastfeed children because I wouldn't be over here minding my business breastfeeding my own baby. I'd be in your house breastfeeding yours. But that's not the world we live in anymore. And there's also a certain white woman who is struggling to, I feel, evolve from that dynamic of being in actual community with racialized women and not just viewing us as lesser beings in some way. And most, I feel, aren't even aware of the fact that that's what they're doing. I think before we really started recording, we talked about unsolicited advice and how it's either them assuming you're a stupid piece of shit or them being incredibly kind of off the wall. And so much of my interaction with white women, unfortunately, is me telling them, like, hey, I'm not actually stupid. I'm a very capable being. And I'd appreciate if you just not assume that, and especially when you're not even aware that that's the assumption that you're making. The lack of self-awareness is incredibly frustrating sometimes. And part of me making my journals was just so I can have those people interrogate themselves instead of me having to constantly interrogate them in my comments. Yeah, I'm not sure if I answered the actual
Oh,
question.
that's a great answer. So we talked about your other two books, but I want to talk about your Decentering Whiteness journal because I think I love how you talk about how like supremacy culture is often the same across different axes of oppression. And I think that is something that is often really difficult for white left-leaning women to see, that the kind of
Yeah.
oppression they experience
There's
has.
no war but class war, you know?
Oh God. Thank you. Thank you. But it's like similar dynamics, and that they are often behaving in the very same behaviors. And I say they, but I mean we, and myself included, and I have to continuously be mindful of this. Engaging in these same behaviors that we have been taught harm us, but that we've also been taught to do to harm other people. So I think your book is a really good antidote to this. And would you like to talk a little about it?
So my Decentering Whiteness is my second favorite. After, and I do have two editions of that because I have Decentering Whiteness for white people, and then I also have it for black people because there's another a lot of internalized anti-blackness that black people need to work through. And you know, that's a lot of work that I had to do with myself when I was younger, decentering whiteness within myself, the same way that I had to learn to decenter men rather. But decentering whiteness is just kind of a way for white people to interrogate ideas that were taught about supremacy and the idea of whiteness as the default, right? Because when you are the majority in any population, and like I said, most of America is in some way segregated, your community is most likely filled with other people like you, and even if there are colorful faces, the chances of you being kind of really close to them in a way that you get to know kind of the intricacies and nuances of their culture is rare. Now, my best friend in the whole world is a white woman, but we met in group homes as teenagers. And so she does have that level of kind of like knowledge of intricacy and cultural nuance because we literally grew up together and lived together in very close quarters. But most people don't have that experience. And most people, unfortunately, over the course of their life, don't cultivate that experience. Or, you know, that experience for whatever reason is, you know, impractical for some people based on where they live. And so decentering whiteness was a way for me to, one, not have to be a personal anti-racism tutor in my comment section every single day. Look, you want me to help you be less racist? I made something for you to do that. You can go do it. And you can pay me for it. So I'm not doing it for free. And just kind of to, I know sometimes in like my comments online, I can be very sort of brash and crude, but that's because of the volume of comments that I get that are the exact same. There's only so many times you can answer the same question before it's like, look, bitch. But I purposely make the tone of my journals very kind of tender and vulnerable because I do understand that that work needs to be done, right? It needs to be done, and you attract more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And so it allows people to interrogate this idea of whiteness as the default in a way that a lot of people say is really useful to them. Like if you ever have a chance to check out the reviews on my site, people are like, wow, like this is paradigm shifting for me. I actually am gonna look up one review in particular and actually read it because it really accomplished what I was hoping it would do. And so, give me a
Read
second while I do that.
Yeah, no, people like really, they love these books and they're just so great. I was also thinking about, so I live in Atlanta where, if you're a white person who doesn't have a lot of black friends living in Atlanta, it's a sure sign that there's something wrong with you. But there are lots of places in the country where there aren't a lot of Black people. And I do kind of wonder if you have become a lot of these people's like Black friend. Like you're the Black person they
Like their
know.
parasocial Black friend. I think I have. And, that is a blessing and a curse. Because one, yes, the more exposure, we know for a fact that the more exposure people have to people that are not like them, the less racist they'll be. Just by nature of understanding and building empathy for people. But also that is a lot of pressure because a lot of people, when I cease to be the perfect little Negro friend that they thought I would be in their mind, they want to attack me, and I'm not ever going to be a perfect victim for an unprovoked attack. and so, there's a lot of that too. I did find the review.
All right, let's hear it.
I'm still working through the workbook, but it is a fantastic tool for white folks who want to be better. Most of us don't know how, and we get caught up in our feelings of shame and end up making it about us and our desire to be recognized as one of the good ones instead of focusing on how we can mitigate harm that our society has done, often with our unintentional, sometimes help to BIPOC. This book deconstructs every way our society has taught us from childhood to center whiteness. It's not about making anyone feel bad for stuff they did when they didn't know better, but rather about freeing us from the toxic mindset that causes us to harm and alienate from our fellow human. Any actual good person should want that. Thank you, Kiki, for putting this out in the world. And I love that review because that is exactly what I wanted people to come away with. Like, you don't have to feel shame. You don't need a special cookie for being an ally, but you do need to work through the things that you were taught and unpack them. And that's a very personal journey, which is why, the book asks very personal questions and allows you to work through them. And that, when I saw that review, I immediately shared it everywhere because I was like, this is what this is what I wanted. And it's always, as a writer, the best thing when you feel like people are coming away with exactly what you wanted them to.
I think that's just a great review. And I mean, I've been actively trying to be anti-racist for a long time. You never fully achieve anti-racism, just like you don't ever fully achieve anti-sexism or any, this is this culture in which we live. And I remember when I first started reading books about anti-racism, like years ago, they were mostly focused on getting you to recognize the problem. Here's the statistics, here's how it affects people, and that's really important. But at a certain point, recognizing the problem doesn't really like excise the socialization from your brain.
Exactly. And that's what my journals are at the crux, what I hope they do, that you interrogate how you specifically have been socialized and that you unpack the way that that socialization affects the people around you. Those grunting sounds in the background are the sounds of a newborn trying to poop. You are welcome for his vocal
I
stylings.
send him well wishes for a good poop. He's just precious. All right. Well, Kiki, this has been wonderful. I'm so glad you came on, and I hope that you will come back to discuss more of this because you're just amazing in every way. And I hope everyone will buy your books because they really offer something that I've not been able to find like anywhere else.
I appreciate that, Zahn, and this is a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. And listeners, we will be back next week. So thank you so much for listening.